You don't need a system outage to know when your PPE isn't delivering what it should. Maybe pricing takes an extra step to verify, maybe updates are taking longer than expected, maybe your team has built workarounds just to keep loans moving. What starts as a few small delays can gradually become the way the work gets done. The reality is, a modern PPE should do more than provide pricing. It should deliver real-time accuracy, seamless workflow execution, intelligent automation, and the confidence to act without hesitation. It should help your team move faster, operate more efficiently, and focus on performance, not process. So ask yourself, is your PPE helping your organization perform at its full potential, or is it forcing your team to work around its limitations? Take a closer look at what you should expect from a modern pricing engine. Visit optimalblue.com/optimalblueppe. Again, that's optimalblue.com/optimalblueppe. Stop accepting friction as part of the process. Make sure your PPE is helping your team move faster, execute smarter, and capture every opportunity.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Operations at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to another July episode of Optimal Insights. Thanks for listening to us today. And we are here making sure that you know what to watch out for, whether you're an originator, capital markets person, or just someone who's interested in the mortgage industry and some great market commentary. On that note, we will get into a solid market update here in just a moment with Alex and James. And then after that, we will visit with Brennan and Mike, and we will go through the Market Advantage Report. Before we get into any of that, just in the way of very high level rate data, 10-year Treasury still stubbornly high, 4.6% as of right this second. And the OBMMI, so the average conventional 30-year rate, is up back up to 6.5. So not what we want to see, certainly reflecting some things that are going on economically and also geopolitically there. So, you know, there's no expectations out there to go much higher or much lower than that 6.5 mark, unfortunately. But we'll talk about some of those things here in a second. Welcome, gentlemen. Thanks for being here, as always.
Morning. How are you?
Good, good. Hope you all had a good weekend. So let's talk through it. So a couple things happened last week. And then we've got a couple things to look forward to this week. One is that road to housing bill that we've been talking about off and on for, it feels like, the last year. And I think that might be about right. This is the housing bill that, you know, there's been various versions out there, as there is with any usually major law that gets changed or gets created. It bounces back between the House and the Senate and the Democrats and the Republicans. And the final bill was finally sent up to the president for signing a couple of weeks ago. So this is the bill that essentially looks to address the supply side of housing. So it has some low-income housing pieces in it. It has some sort of standardized regulation in it as well to try to streamline, if states adopt the framework of it, look to streamline building new neighborhoods, financing for housing, that sort of thing. It also has the much debated institutional investor ban in it. So essentially, it's what it comes down to, or what it ended up being, was an institution cannot own more than 350 properties. So that's a lot of properties, but there's certainly some, you know, hedge funds and banks out there that own at least that many properties. It doesn't require that those entities then sell properties to get below that 350. It just means going forward, you can't buy any more properties. You can't buy enough properties to get over 350. So it is what people wanted in general. I think there's still some debate on whether that makes a dent in housing appreciation. Some think that it's a bad idea because if we do have like a crash in housing prices, that there wouldn't be that institutional buyer to come in and save the day. But who knows? Well, I guess we'll find. Hopefully, we won't have to find out on the low end if it creates that sort of demand issue. But anyway, the president refused to sign it, right? Because he was, whether it was for show or not, he was demanding the Save America Act be pushed forward, which is basically voter ID law federally. No movement was made there, so he sort of just ignored the bill. And as is law, after 10 days of Congress being in session, any new law that isn't signed by the president becomes law, unless the president vetoes it, which he did not exercise. So it's in place. No immediate changes are expected. It's not going to lower rates. It's not going to make housing cheaper tomorrow, but it's sort of a 5 to 7 year plan. Does that sound right to you guys?
Yeah, no, I think you're dead on that. No one's expecting the housing market to correct itself pricing wise over the next 48 hours. But yeah, it's probably on a decade long time scale. It puts in some levers that should hopefully help to alleviate some of the pressures that we see. I personally thought Trump might actually exercise that veto, but as you said, it was so overwhelmingly supported in Congress by both Democrats and Republicans that it might have made the veto look pretty weak and just easily been overridden. So it is law, as you said.
Okay. Yeah, it wasn't going away. And it may have just been symbolic that he refused to sign it, knowing that it was going to become law anyway. Signing it would have been one less opportunity to kind of publicize the voter ID discussion. Yeah, I mean, what's going on in the Middle East? Is it Groundhog's Day over there? It feels like oil's up, rates are up, tensions are high. The Strait is, maybe it's open, maybe it's closed. Is that generally what we're seeing?
Yeah, well, it seems to be where we're back to today. Last week, we saw tensions slowly ramp up after Iran, I think, launched some drones at some cargo ships. Iran alleged that they had failed to comply with Iranian commands in how they were conducting their transit through the Strait of Hormuz. And since then, it's really just escalated from there. The U.S. has continued to strike sites along the coast in southern Iran, and Iran has responded mainly by hitting targets in Bahrain, Jordan, regional, maybe not U.S. allies, but U.S. Aligned nations, which is how the war played itself out back in April, May. So, yeah, it seems that we're back to more of a hot conflict. Markets so far haven't really, oil's up a little bit, but nowhere near where it was during the main conflict that we saw back in May. So I think, at least for the moment, markets seem to be kind of calling the bluff on this one of, yeah, we're going to see both sides do some strikes, but we'll see another memorandum of understanding or peace deal here in the next week or two.
Right. Okay. So still something to keep an eye on. As long as the tensions in the Strait remain elevated, you're going to see a floor under rates probably. We still continue to see 6.5 on the 30-year, and then a 4.6, 4.5 on the 10-year. We also had last week the Fed minutes, which, first meeting post Kevin Warsh entering the picture as the chair. I guess it was as expected. There was expected to be some disagreement within the Fed, even though they came out unanimously for a pause. There was, anyway, discussion on whether there should be hikes later this year or early next year, and a little bit of, I don't know, they called it like family fighting, right? Just within the FOMC.
Yeah, the minutes kind of revealed what a lot of us, I think, knew. Warsh is thinking a little bit differently than, say, Powell had previously, that rates are being looked at through a different light, and he's looking at the handle on inflation rather than the whole item. So it's a pushback on the idea that, hey, rates are might be increasing. He's saying, they need to stay where they are. We might be able to get them down. And it really was a big disagreement between the current sitting members and Warsh in his first run. He will have more to say later this week. He's going to be testifying in front of Congress, and I'm sure that they will be grilling him on how exactly he intends to be communicating with all of us moving forward and what exactly he's seeing on rates. I'm sure they'll try and pin him to say something more substantial.
Sure. Yeah, that's a tough gig, right? Like, we all see it from the more of the diplomatic side. We see the public persona of Warsh and some of the other Fed heads, and they sort of have prescribed what they can say and what they're going to say in public. But this is a new boss, right? The new boss walks in, new leader of the FOMC, and you kind of have to win the hearts and minds a little bit, don't you? You can't, you know, people are going to have their own opinions. Everyone wants to be heard. Some people want that job someday. So there's going to be this, you would think they're not just going to immediately fall in line. Otherwise, why are there so many members of the board, right? It's interesting to think about what it might really look like behind the closed doors, right? When they're having these more frank or open conversations about how to basically manage the world economy.
Absolutely. I think Warsh came in more so than any other Fed head in recent history with his own baggage, probably a little awkward walking into that room on the first day, just knowing all the drama that's transpired over the last 12 months in regards to Powell and the Fed's independence, and then Warsh's confirmation within itself. So yeah, no, I think when he says we're having a good family fight, I think you're right, Jim. I think they're speaking pretty frankly behind closed doors, but it remains to be seen if we get a cut this year, or rather a hike this year. There are, I guess, arguments out there for a cut, but right now I think we're looking at a hike likely in September. Again, it really seems to be driven by this energy price shock we've seen from the conflict in the Middle East, which I think could give them the cover that they need to hike. Whether you agree with that or not is up for debate. And I think this might be one of the more hotly contested decisions for the FOMC that we've seen in recent years. In fact, we might not even see, you know, it could be a thin margin vote, I would have to imagine.
Right. Still seeing these sort of rifts or this separation within the Fed, whereas you look previous years and there's been generally a unanimous vote, but it does feel like the last couple Jerome Powell votes that there could be some dissent, or maybe a good amount, like split down the middle. You know, one vote makes the difference. So that'll be fun to watch. And we get a little bit of fuel this week, right? We have a full raft of inflation numbers. James, have you been following this much? Do you know what we're expecting here? And if we're going to shrug off a high number because of the war is expected to be temporary or transient, if you will?
Yeah, that is exactly right. So this week we're going to see both CPI and PPI. Both these measures are expected to be reduced compared to how they were last month. CPI, a little bit more interesting to me. It's going to be expected to be down 0.2%. So as a year-over-year value, this would take us to about 2.8. Again, the idea that Warsh is looking at the handle rather than the whole number means he sees this as a 2, right? Rounding down. And that's right on target. So right where you'd want to be. I'm not sure I'd love that argument, but it is, you know, it is below 3. It is below like a kind of a eyebrow raiser. Rates are far too high from where they want to be. It is with that price coming down as the ceasefire came, as ships started transporting through the Strait of Hormuz, oil prices came down pretty dramatically. Gas prices still lagging, but they have come down from the mid 4s down to, it's a, you know, $3.80 average in the state of Maryland. It's about the same, a little higher nationally. So gas prices are looking in the right direction. All of that, you know, bleeds through. So we are going to see a shock the other way, prices coming down. You know, the inflation is always going to be persistent. The impacts of higher gas prices from earlier will still kind of echo later in this year. And even though we might see an immediate come down, it's almost as though we've come from a very high outlier back to just a high number. So that reduction shouldn't be viewed as a, you know, huge victory yet. It's just a step back from a massive step up.
Mm-hmm. A bit of a hangover. Mm. Yeah. And I wonder too about this round of inflation. Almost, you could look at it as the same round that we went through after the pandemic, 23, 24. We were making progress. Then we have this shock from oil prices. Meanwhile, inflation was just still elevated above where the Fed would typically like to see it, whether you're looking at the handle or the overall number. But at the same time, you've got a consumer that's like increasingly stressed every month. Record level of consumer debt, rent and housing is still an extreme burden on most households. You add to that the inflation of gasoline and food. I wonder if some of what's keeping inflation low is a little bit of the demand side. It's just folks are running out of money. Not what you love to think about, because that's typically what triggers something like could be a credit crisis or some sort of credit event that could be coming in the near future. Can be good for interest rates in the long run because of what the FOMC might have to do about something like that, or just generally how bonds get traded. But anyway, it just pops in my head sometimes when I think about how spending was rampant in the early days of the coming out of the pandemic. People had paid down debt, had saved money, so they almost didn't care what Uber Eats cost. People are just kind of blowing cash. But now it's a little bit different. It feels like some of that is keeping CPI especially lower, even when PPI rises as some of these goods get more expensive or fuel gets more expensive. I don't know. Alex, you got any thoughts on that? Just the general health of the consumer today versus when we were fighting inflation, 2-3 years ago?
Sure. I mean, anecdotally speaking, I feel like you talk to just about anybody on the street and you quote the inflation rate to them, they'll cock their eyebrow and say, "You believe that number?"
That too.
I think a lot of people, they're under the impression that inflation's running a little hotter even than the official numbers would say. That could just be that their basket of goods is a little bit different than the basket of goods that is being sampled for these inflation metrics. But that seems to be the again, anecdotally, the most oft cited thing that I hear about the economy is that the basket of goods folks are taking home every month is definitely pressing on the wallet. The numbers it shows the inflation rate's high. At the same time, though, wage growth, it remains decently strong, which is another point in favor of the Fed potentially hiking rates, as strong wage growth can be a prelude to further inflation. As if you have more dollars in your pocket, you're more likely to pursue additional goods. Yeah, I remember in 23 and 24, I felt like the news cycle was always citing all those savings from COVID. And to me, it didn't feel as if people had really continued to use those savings 3-4 years after the pandemic. But you're definitely not seeing that line included in, the economics write-ups that, in the news anymore. So I am in agreement with you. I think, the average consumer is definitely feeling the press on the wallet from multiple sides. Yeah, the savings are exhausted. They, while the numbers that are being released look strong on paper, when it comes to reality, they don't feel that they're all that strong. Yeah, no, I'm with you, and I think I'm in fairly large agreement.
Yeah, the questioning of the survey numbers is another piece of that. Is everybody's inflation number is different based on what they buy and where they live, right? It's not the family of five in Indiana necessarily. You have kind of a different spectrum of goods that you spend your money on. And yeah, people are, the unemployment rate is good. Wages are growing. Corporate earnings are very good. So the stock market is performing well, but that doesn't necessarily translate to the average American doing well and thinking that the economy is doing well. And that's evident in almost any article you read and any poll about, as we lead up to an election later this year. People are not thrilled about what's going on with the economy, but they are exuberant about investing and some other areas where people are making money. All right. What else, gentlemen? Did we miss anything?
I don't think so. Just keep your eye on those inflation numbers. They'll definitely be driving the next 60, 70 days of, economics talk and into the lead up for these FOMC meetings in July and September.
Absolutely. All right. Next, we will hear from Brennan and Mike. They will give us the lowdown and the highlights of the Market Advantage Report. Let's kick it over to them. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Welcome, everyone, to the June Market Advantage Data Summary. We had another exciting month here with lots of data changes and new trends to call out. Brennan, you want to kick us off with the origination trends?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy, I guess, July now to everyone. Hope everybody had a good 4th of July holiday. June, optimism was in the air. So we had lock activity pretty strong, despite some slightly higher rate environments to deal with sort of across the board. Total lock volume rose 9.7% month over month, nearly 15% from the same time in 2025. Purchase activity continued to lead the markets. I think we had a strong kind of like late spring, early summer push on the home buying market. Purchase volumes increased 10% from May and nearly 14% versus June of last year. Cash out refi volumes grew 11% month over month and 10% year over year. And rate term refi activity increased 6% from May and approximately 32% from the same period last year. So not a necessarily a better month, but I think we did see some pickup, maybe an extra business day in there, but just generally speaking, some good optimism in June. Refi activity is representing about 18 to 19% of total lock volume. It's basically unchanged from May, but it's, you know, certainly materially higher than some of the other months that we saw. And in years gone by, purchase loans accounting for the rest of that, just over 81% of total production. Mortgage rates, like I said, mixed. The conforming 30-year rate, the benchmark that Optimum Blue offers, that's the benchmark that sits behind the CME mortgage rate futures, that finished June at 6.45%, up a bip over the same for the end of May and 10 bips above March level. So we're quite a bit higher than where we finished Q1, but still 22 basis points lower than June of 2025. FHA rates increased a couple of bips to finish the month at 6.29. VA rates declined mostly flat, 2 bips to 6.03. And jumbo rates, this is where we did see some improvement, fell 30 bips to 6.4%. So some of the non-agency production certainly benefited from a downturn or a downtick in jumbo rates. The 10-year finished a month at 4.44%, roughly flat. And the spread between the 10-year and the 30-year mortgage rate sat around 200 basis points, pretty similar to where it's been the last couple of months. I would say, you know, looking at this purchase lock volume as we get into the late spring, early summer buying season, we're up 14% year over year and really reached its highest level since spring. So I think that's where a lot of the optimism is coming from. In terms of loan amount, we're creeping back. We had hit $400,000 earlier in the year, fell back, and we were at $399,000 in June. So very high. I mean, it's not necessarily great from a first-time home buyer or affordability perspective, but in terms of origination volume, seeing those loan volumes tick higher is a nice sign. Product mix continued to shift away from agency lending. Conforming share fell to just below 49% of total production. So we're consistently now here under 50% of production going to Fannie and Freddie eligible products. Non-conforming lending continuing to expand. As I mentioned, the jumbo rates were quite a bit lower in June. So that's non-conforming is inclusive of both jumbo and non-QM lending. Expanded to 19.3% of volume, highest share in a number of years, and reflected continued demand for those products I mentioned. FHA represented 18.7%, and VAs were about 12.5% of total production. Last point I would make here is that property type trends. So we did see, it's sort of gone in waves since 2022 of how much of the new housing stock is driving the purchase market. So we track planned unit developments, PUDs, and they're a pretty good proxy on our platform for new construction activity. And we're up to 28% of total volume in June. So continues to tick a little bit higher. You know, we've seen this sort of new build story ebb and flow. And it's an interesting one as we get into the summer months and we start to see more new home builds come on the market. So it'll be interesting to see how much of new construction sort of takes over the share of new properties or the purchase demand in summer of 2026. And with that, I think I'll pass it back to you, Mike. What are we seeing on the secondary set?
Thanks, Brandon. The big story kind of starting off this month was kind of a tale of two stories with best effort mandatory spread. So just to remind folks, that's the spread between a best effort lock and selling a loan in the secondary market. And it's effectively how investors look at the hedge cost or the ability of moving that interest rate risk off their books to a lender to manage, right? And that's where a lot of our hedging solutions come in to really make those economics make sense. And we saw the conventional 30-year best effort mandatory spread drop 9 basis points from 40 to 31, while we saw the government 30 actually increase 6 basis points from 12 to 18 basis points. So kind of hard to say what the exact factor is. Maybe we're seeing some volatility go down, but to see both of those move in different directions is definitely a trend for us to keep an eye on going into next month. Another one that's a kind of a continuation of previous trends was the shift away from agency MBS securitizations. We saw that drop another percentage point this month to 40% of loan sales. This was closer to 50 about 4 months ago. And we've seen both the aggregator share and the agency cash window share take away from that. But this was the first month in a while that we actually saw best efforts committing and take a percentage point. It went from 2% of our loan sales to 3% of our loan sales, which is interesting. Typically, you see lenders sell to that execution if it's not updating as quickly as the market, or if there are CRA bids or really specified pay-up stories that are embedded in someone's best effort rate sheet. So again, definitely a trend to watch, but hard to say exactly why that changed. Another trend to keep an eye out for was our loan sales and where they actually went to from a price perspective. The share of loans sold to the first price increased from 77 to 78% of our loan sales, where our second and third ranked price both dropped a percentage point. And then we saw the loan sold to the fourth or worse actually increase a percentage point. So everybody was up a percent or down a percent last month. The interesting one to watch was that fourth or lower ranked price execution went from 6% of our loan sales to 7% of our loan sales. So what that means is lenders are you know, looking at things other than price to kind of gauge their best X. So whether that is an investor has a quicker turn time, maybe there's a representative mix that they're looking to manage across their different outlets. Hey, making sure that you're not, you know, giving too much of one product or one type of loan to a specific investor to manage the overall relationship. Or there could be pooling constraints that folks are looking at. Like, hey, I want to move a loan out of a lower low balance loan to a multi-issuer pool. There's a variety of reasons of doing that. Our software at Optimal Blue helps folks do that. So, you know, there's ways to program these rules in here. So I kind of cringe a little bit every time I see that percentage change, because there's ways to automate and put those into the system. So it shows up as your rank one, even though the price isn't your rank one. So there's some work for our lenders to do there. We also saw MSR values decrease a little bit this month, which is actually interesting considering rates on average were up compared to last month, albeit quite immaterial of an amount to your points from earlier. Couple reasons why this might be the case. You know, we did see the shape of the yield curve change a little bit. Theory would be that maybe the, you know, retention projections for folks might be decreasing a little bit, given, you know, rates kind of staying higher here. We saw the 30-year servicing rate drop about 3 basis points to 1.33 on a 25 bip servicing strip. That's still a 5.3 multiple, pretty rich and pretty healthy. So not much to fret about there. And then the last point that I wanted to call out is that we actually saw our investor count stay flat at 14 bidders. That's still a pretty healthy amount for a majority of 25 and 24 was in that 12 to 13 range. So this is basically just showing a proxy for demand out there, that there are plenty of investors that are bidding on the average loan sale tape that's going through our systems today. But that wraps up for the hedging side. Any last points you want to hit, Brendan, to get us out of this?
No, I would just say to all those depressed soccer fans who watched the United States fumble in the round of 16, it's probably par for the course for our men's soccer team, but still plenty of good World Cup games to watch. So hopefully everybody enjoys July and we'll see you in August.
Yeah, it was great to see soccer kind of sweep the nation and you know, everybody get behind the guys in red, white, and blue. It'll be interesting to see if, you know, 10 years from now, we're able to see a little bit of a soccer boom from just the popularity of this World Cup being on U.S. soil. I know Portugal is only a 5-hour flight from us East Coasters, and that's where the next World Cup is. Maybe there's a way for us to, maybe we'll take it on the road. I've been to Portugal before. It's a really beautiful country. So it's a cool venue for the next one.
Yeah, you heard it here. 2030 Market Advantage report coming to you live from Portugal.
We'll be in Porto. It'll be great. But we appreciate everybody, listening to the podcast, and we'll see everybody next month.
And that's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.